Timothy Evans was a single man who could neither read nor write. In 1947, aged 22, he married Beryl Thawley. The following year, their only child, Geraldine, was born. On November the 8th, 1949, Beryl was strangled and then raped. 2 days later, baby Geraldine was also murdered. Evans was arrested, tried, and found guilty. Mr. Justice Lewis donned the black cap and sentenced Evans to be hanged. On March the 9th, 1950, confused, dim-witted Timothy Evans was executed at Pentonville Prison. But he wasn't guilty. He'd only been convicted on the evidence of John Christie, who lived in the flat just underneath. It was, in fact, Christie who had killed Beryl and Geraldine, and indeed six other women. In 1953, Christie was caught and executed for the murder of his own wife. And it was then that the horror began to dawn upon the public that an innocent man had been executed. It took 13 years for officialdom to admit the improbability of two mass murderers living in the same house. In July 1965, 113 members of Parliament demanded an inquiry, and a posthumous free pardon was eventually granted to poor Timothy Evans. It was this realization that an innocent man had suffered irretrievable ruin as the result of false testimony that, more than any other factor, paved the way for the abolition of capital punishment in this country. Now, so seriously was the Ninth Commandment taken in primitive Israel, when in the intensity of the wilderness training, a number of transgressions of the law were punishable by death, that to give a false witness was seen as equivalent to murder. As a deterrent against giving false witness, it was even ruled in Deuteronomy 17, verse 7, that the person who gave witness of a capital offense against someone must be the first to take part in the execution itself. And in that way, false witnesses would know for sure that they were guilty of murder. The more I thought about this ninth commandment, the more I've had to recognize the immense breadth of life and experience that it covers. You realize, too, I hope, that the preacher of this sermon is sitting right there among you in the congregation. The words, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor," are words for him as they are for everybody else. No culture, no century finds these words of no relevance. Way back in the 5th century BC, we find Dionysius of Syracuse visiting Plato, the great philosopher, at the Academy in Athens. "Why have you come?" asked Plato. "Why," replied Dionysius, "I thought that you'd be talking against me to your students." Plato gave a good answer. "Dost thou think, Dionysius, we are so destitute of matter to converse upon that we talk of thee?" Yes, Greece knew about those possible tendencies, those fears. There's an old Persian proverb that warns against the backbiting of apparent friends. "Every man," it says, "has 100 faces." The implication is that you don't know who your friends are. They may be saying all sorts of things behind your back, despite the smiling countenance. So the ninth commandment, while applicable in the first instance to false witness in matters of law, carries over into the vast natural assize of public opinion, a court with far greater influence than any other in the world, a court which is unceasing and always in permanent session. Public opinion. You don't have to be a verbal strategist to bear false witness in that court. You can participate in it simply by being a willing listener. You can transgress the ninth commandment by a sympathetic nod, a shrug of the shoulder, the lifted eyebrow, the tut-tut by a wink, by quoting half of an original statement and passing that half on to others, or by jumping to conclusions on the strength of a half-heard remark. Holiness of life is no shield from slander. Joseph of old, you will remember in the book of Genesis, suffered from Potiphar's wife in Egypt. The righteous Naboth lost his life as a result of Jezebel's slander in 1 Kings chapter 21. And Jesus Christ himself is, of course, the supreme example. So straight talking is our theme, and let's establish right away first that straight talking is consistent with the nature of God. Yes, I want to put it positively rather than negatively. I don't want to say that twisted talk is inconsistent with the nature of God. I'd like to put it positively this morning. Straight talking is consistent with the very nature of God. This is what the people of Israel were learning in all of that period at Sinai and in their journeyings towards their promised land. What is God like? They were asking. What is his nature? On the revelation that they were being given then was to rest the ordering, the life, the procedures of whole civilizations to come. What is God like? They were asking at Sinai. And little by little, the picture was being assembled. God is the center of truth. He provides the yardstick for the relationship between things, for the setting out of the facts, for the constitution of our existence. Truth itself can only be defined by the eternal, unwaveringly consistent God, who in space and time and history has expressed himself to us with laws and standards that are fixed. The Greek sage Pythagoras of the 6th century BC was once asked what made people to be like God. He answered, when they speak truth. The psalmist of the Old Testament would agree. O God, he asked, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? The answer comes in the next sentence. It's the person who speaks truth from his heart, does not slander with his tongue, does no evil to his neighbor. Psalm 15, verses 1 to 3. And that's the person who can live with God. Because truthful, straight talking is consistent with his nature. The first lie that is told in the Bible comes from an angelic being who deviated and rebelled against the God of truth, and so gained a lying nature. Jesus said of him in John 8, verse 44, he has nothing to do with the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks according to his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So when you and I come up against, as we do, movements and groups that don't truly have God's interests at heart, but only their own cause and little empire that they're building up, it shouldn't be too surprising to discover that truthful standards have a low place on their agenda. The end justifies the means. We see this in the religious realm as well as in the secular. There's a religious sect today that uses the Bible, but also instructs its devotees to use what is blandly called heavenly deception in its recruitment methods. To gain a convert, it may be necessary, so it is claimed, to tell a lie. The believer in God, the follower of Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life, has to fight against untruthful speaking and false testimony throughout the whole of life. We're always with it. Every day will present an array of temptations at work, in the family, with colleagues and friends, the issues to what we listen to, what we believe. And the particular temptation to speak a word falsely against another person or to comply with somebody else's unchristian initiative is very, very strong. As the Good News Version translates Proverbs 26, verse 22, gossip is so tasty, how we love to swallow it. Of course, we're not required to be in sweet agreement with everything and everybody. There was no straighter talking or stronger criticism than Christ's. There's nothing against having a critical faculty. It's the critical spirit that has to be corrected and tempered with grace. In Christ, we read in John 1:14, resided that wonderful combination of grace and truth in one and the same person. So that's my first proposition, that straight talking is consistent with the very nature of God. A second proposition, straight talking is consistent with the family of God. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Here it is, Exodus 20:16. And Israel was a family, a human laboratory, in which the relationships and structures of living together in harmonious community had to be steadily and often painfully hammered out. We do it here too. The Christian church had to learn the same lessons. And so many of those New Testament letters were written to buttress those believers, those new believers, from the atmosphere of distrust and suspicion that pervaded all of first century society. So in Ephesians 4:25, therefore, putting away falsehood, let everyone speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. It was the sense of family gathered under the headship of Jesus Christ that was to provide the incentive for unity and the deterrent against party faction and intrigue. As a preacher of old once put it, if thou wouldst keep thyself from being a slanderer of others, addict not thyself violently to any one party or persuasion. No, straight talking is consistent with the family of God. It's when we know ourselves to be partners of each other in the same family, and servants, not competitors, under Christ our Lord and Master, that the note of bitter complaint and backbiting behind the scenes goes right out of the window, out of our discipleship, out of our service. It's when we forget that we are but servants of the whole family that we try to edge ourselves up the ladder of public esteem and recognition and are quite content to have colleagues and fellow Christians brought down a rung or two. So when your own position or your own group means more to you than God and his family, or when it happens to a clergyman that his own church means more to him than God and his family, then it is that the temptation comes to begin to lie or to exaggerate or to denigrate others, to harp on the weaknesses of others, which is why the Apostle Paul in Philippians 2:3 urges his friends, in humility, count others better than yourselves. It is a word for us. Again, Colossians 3:8, put them all away. Anger, wrath, malice, slander. And so for Christian workers here, let's face those questions quite firmly. First, are the secrets of others safe in your hands? And secondly, are the reputations of others safe in your hands? The difficulty sometimes is that everybody has a best friend. So the sentence, this is for your ears alone, or piously, as it's sometimes put, this is just for your prayers. Yes, it can be all right, of course it can. But how often have rumors and little pieces of careless, unchecked gossip gone spreading like a prairie fire throughout a community because everybody had a best friend, a confidant. You will perhaps remember the quote from D.L. Moody, the American of the last century. A rumor will travel halfway round the world before the truth has got its boots on. So we do beware of the pious cover-up. I've learnt over the years, partly because I've done it myself, to beware when the name of some Christian person is preceded by the phrase, "Dear old so-and-so." Because it's too often the pious prelude to a snide criticism that is either untrue or unkind or unnecessary. "Dear old Jim, of course he is his own worst enemy," or whatever. How do we offset that tendency to bring a false witness against others? The answer lies in several directions. Partly by having a sober estimate of our own weaknesses and failings. Partly by checking ourselves repeatedly by that old, well-tried threefold question: is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? But also to focus upon the positive. After all, if you are spiteful or catty, it's no use being told, "Oh, please don't be spiteful, don't be catty." Instead, let's cultivate the practice of the opposite, with Christ, the head of the Christian family, as our helper and our model. Let's provoke one another to accuracy and care in this respect within the fellowship. Yes, within the fellowship group. We do so on our own ministry team. From time to time, we will just, one or other of us, will pull another up. Say, "Let's be careful." Learn to praise others. And in particular, let's learn to praise those very people who operate in our own particular field, in our own speciality, in our own department, in our own professional area of expertise. Musicians, singers, can you praise those very musicians who play your instrument, who threaten even to take your place as they improve? I try and do this in a field in which I've had a little experience only, that of broadcasting. When I hear a fellow Christian broadcasting and a tiny voice inside says to me, "They're rather better than you, aren't they?" I have made the astonishing discovery that if I send that person a letter or a card of congratulation and warm appreciation, it melts away that little area of hardness within me that could so easily resent their success. It's a therapy. It is astonishing. Try it if you haven't already done so. We'll all practice it. I'll give you an example. Even though Wesley and Whitfield, 200 years ago, the great evangelists, didn't always agree at every point in their ministry, they discouraged their followers from spreading criticism about the other. One small-minded disciple of Wesley said to him, "Do you think that we shall see Mr. Whitfield in heaven?" "No," replied Wesley, and the man looked rather pleased that he'd aimed his flattery well. "No, sir," said Wesley, "I fear not. Mr. Whitfield will be so near the throne, and we at such a distance, we shall hardly get a sight of him." That was well spoken. Practice the good, and it will prove stronger than the harboring of evil that would put down that potential competitor. I like the story of George Beverly Shea, the gospel singer, who once remarked in an interview that his godly mother hated to speak ill of anybody. One day, he said, "My sister Lois said to me, 'You notice that mother never speaks ill of anyone. I'm going to get her tonight at the dinner table. You wait.'" So, says George Beverly Shea, we waited. Lois finally said, "Mother, what do you think of the devil?" Mother came back with the reply, "I admire his persistence." Well, maybe she took it a little bit too far. Straight talking, practice it. Practice it. It's consistent with the nature of God, and it's consistent with the family of God. Last proposition. Straight talking is consistent with the mission of God. Archbishop Michael Ramsay, former Archbishop of Canterbury, was once visiting a theological college, and the students were peppering him with questions. One of them said, "What is the greatest hindrance to Christian mission today, Archbishop?" He replied, he thought for a moment, and then he replied one word, "Gossip." If you weigh that, think about it. It's very, very true. He was a wise man. Often it's not even evil talk that impedes the mission of God in our world, but careless talk. The kind of talk that forgets it's God's mission, his precious mission, that we're involved in, and treats it almost as a game of politics. And sees Christian work and enterprise almost like a game of chess. Who's in these days? Who's on their way down? Who's on their way up? I recall seeing an article in a Christian magazine a while back, which fell right into the very trap that Christ's disciples fell into when they were arguing about who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. The article in question speculating on who were the most influential evangelicals today. A batty question when you put it into the context of Christ's words and standards. Cuts clean across the message, the style, the whole Christ-centeredness of what is, after all, God's mission to our poor, struggling world. So Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, said many years ago, "Do you wish people to believe good of you? Don't speak." He'd been warned enough. He was referring to the damage done by the tongue, damage that is highlighted in James chapter 3, where we had our reading earlier on, and verse 5. "So the tongue is a little member and boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire set on fire by hell." See how these Christians love one another. That's the testimony, surely, that would be consistent with God's mission in Christ to our world. The words that we have said, sometimes quite idly, let's remember that those very words, unless they're forgiven by Christ, could one day be trumpeted upon the housetops. So Jesus said, Luke 12, verse 2, "Nothing is covered up that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in private rooms shall be shouted upon the housetops." Jesus said that. Warning of judgment. God's mission demands the highest standard anywhere to be found. We're to see to it then that we practice the virtues of goodness and generosity, honor, integrity, wise discretion. Let's see to it that we're not the kind of people who wittingly or unwittingly are the occasion of stumbling by which others tell lies. Perhaps because so acid is our own tongue, the people will lie to our faces because they're afraid of us. Are you that kind of person? There was a person a little bit like that, a little bit like that, way back in our own family, years back. I'll change her name. I'll call her Great Aunt Kitty. She was the dragon of all super dragons. Everybody was a little bit afraid of Great Aunt Kitty. And so the word got around in the family. A lie told to Great Aunt Kitty is not a lie. That's what was said. No, but it always is a lie. But it would be a pity if any of us were of such a disposition that people are afraid of us and therefore will lie to us, and we never get their confidence. Straight talking is consistent with the nature of God. It's consistent with the family of God. It's consistent with the mission of God. And we may say, we can't change human nature. God can't change me. Look at me now, 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old. Can he change me? The Bible denies the substance of such thinking. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, comes the word from Sinai. And the gospel of grace and forgiveness and of the Spirit's power to change and renew says you can change. You are expected to change. With God's help, it is going to happen.